This is class number 5 in the Econ 111 Economics course. Please submit your assignments for chapters 6 and 7 that are due by this class, as well as the extra credit work associated with those chapters, if you chose to do the extra credit work. Last week we considered the material in chapters 8 and 9. Remember that these are due by the next class. You will recall how earlier in the course we said that the subject of economics is generally divided into two subcategories, macroeconomics and microeconomics. Macroeconomics looks at economics and commerce from the perspective of what we might call a macroscope or telescope. In this macroscope or telescope, we see the economic system as a whole. In contrast, microeconomics looks at economics and commerce from the perspective of what we might call a microscope. It microscopes in on one portion of the economic system, like an individual firm. In considering the law of supply and demand in the last class, for the most part, we considered the topic from a macro perspective. We only deviated from this towards the end of the class when we considered how a demand curve might look from the perspective of a monopolist firm versus a firm in a purely competitive industry. You will recall that we said that for a purely competitive firm, the demand curve would actually appear as horizontal, because no matter the quantity of products sold by a firm in a competitive industry, the price consumers pay for the product would remain fixed. This is because in a competitive industry, there are many, many firms, and no firm commands a significant percentage of the overall market for the product. So the quantity of product made and sold by a particular firm in a purely competitive industry is a drop in the bucket of the overall market in that product. Also, if any firm were to try to sell the product at a price for, say, higher than the prevailing market price, since consumers would have so many other choices of suppliers, they would simply purchase from these other suppliers. So no firm could get away with charging a higher price lest their revenues become zero. Since the price is essentially fixed for the firm, no matter how much the purely competitive firm makes and sells, from the perspective of the firm, the demand curve appears horizontal. For this firm, demand is perfectly price elastic, then. That is, the microeconomic perspective for the firm in a purely competitive industry. But contrast that with the macroeconomic perspective. For the economy as a whole, the demand curve for the product is downward sloping, because it is the case in the market considered as a whole that the quantity demanded for a particular product will increase as the price of the product decreases. Now compare what a firm in a purely competitive industry faces versus a monopolist. Recall that a monopolist is a firm that is the sole supplier of product in a market for the particular product or good or service. Since the monopolist controls the whole market for a given good or service, the monopolist firm's demand curve from the perspective of the firm appears exactly the same as the demand curve for the market as a whole. Since the demand curve for the market as a whole is downward sloping, the demand curve for the monopolist firm from the perspective of the monopolist firm is also downward sloping. The monopolist firm demand is thus more price inelastic than the demand curve faced by a firm in a purely competitive industry. This example illustrates how market dominance can affect economic behavior, a topic which is explored in Chapter 12 of your textbook. So I'd like to highlight just some issues that are raised in Chapter 12 sort of summarize them. So now turning to Chapter 12 in your textbook, entitled The Effect of Market Dominance on Economic Behavior. I am just going to give highlights from that chapter. Reading from the beginning, it says, a firm can be classified in one of four market types: perfect competition, monopolistic competition, oligopoly, and monopoly. These range from most competitive to least competitive, respectively. Perfect competition is a market structure in which there are many competing firms selling identical products or services. Monopolistic competition is a market structure in which there are many firms selling slightly differentiated products or services. Yet this market is quite different from the monopoly market, in which there is virtually no real competition. An oligopoly market contains a few firms who dominate the industry, and one firm's actions is known to very much affect another's. A monopoly is an industry with only one seller. The product which the monopolistic firm sells typically has no close substitutes. Most monopolies in the United States are regulated by our governments, state and local. Characteristics, I'm going to now read to you some characteristics of a purely competitive industry. They are these. There are many sellers and many buyers. Number two, it is relatively easy to start a business in this industry. Number three, one firm's product is identical to a competitor's product. Number four, buyers of the product have complete knowledge of the price and quality of the product. We find purely competitive industry in various sectors of agriculture where many farmers produce the same crop, which then must compete in the open market. A monopoly industry is defined as an industry with only one seller. Typically, a monopoly firm is a large company which sells a product for which there are no close substitutes. Utility companies that sell electricity to customers within a certain region are examples of monopolies. There are alternative ways to generate electricity, but for all practical purposes, only one company provides electricity for a certain population. Now, skipping down, I would like to read to you the four characteristics of monopolistic competition. They are these. One, there are many sellers in this industry. Number two, it's easy for firms to enter into this industry and for existing firms to exit. Number three, firms in this industry sell differentiated products. Number four, firms in this industry frequently advertise. Characteristics 1 and 2 are the same as in perfect competition. Characteristic 3 means that firms in this industry sell products that are similar but slightly different. The difference may lie in the packaging of the product, the ingredients, the service associated with the product, the name of the product, or the difference may even be only perceived by consumers. The advertising helps to emphasize these differences to consumers. These last two characteristics also mean that firms in this industry do not all have to charge the same price for the product. Since the products are slightly different, they can charge different prices. The demand curve is therefore downward sloping from the perspective of the firm in a monopolistic competitive industry. Here are some examples of a monopolistically competitive industries: retail clothing stores, retail shoe stores, gas stations, fast food restaurants, and it gives some others. Monopolistically competitive firms earn normal accounting, or so-called zero economic profits. Firms look at their cost of production and then mark up their prices to obtain a reasonable percentage profit. If any firm marks up its prices too much, another firm will take advantage of it by changing to a slightly lower price. This will cause the first firm to lose market share, and the markup will be adjusted accordingly. This competitive process occurs in any industry, monopolistic competition, oligopoly, or monopoly, as long as there is free, unrestricted competition. It is rare, therefore, to see a firm in any unrestricted industry experience exorbitant above normal economic profits for an extended long-term period of time. Now, I said the third type of firm is an oligopoly, and here are characteristics of an oligopoly. Number one, few sellers who control all or most sales. Number two, barriers to entry. Number three, firms in this industry are interdependent. And number four, advertising is prevalent. Oligopoly firms are usually large relative to the market in which they operate. Consequently, if one oligopoly firm changes its product price or alters another part of its marketing strategy, it will significantly impact the rival firms. For instance, if Pepsi lowers its prices to 50 cents per can, Coke will be affected. Coke most likely will lower its price too. If this happens, neither company will gain a competitive advantage. Some examples of oligopoly industries are the automobile industry, the steel industry, and the photographic equipment industry. So those are some highlights from chapter 12. People who have studied firms have observed and concluded by induction what is I march on to chapter 10, I want to just conclude as far as chapter 12 and say that what you have in chapter 12 is a discussion of different types of firms we find in our economy. Now we're going to be analyzing in more detail the nature of how such firms do business in some subsequent classes. But as you read chapter 12, you should gain an understanding of what these four basic types of industries are. Now, people, moving on to what we'll consider in chapter 10, people who have studied firms have observed and concluded by induction what is called the law of diminishing marginal product. And this is a topic which is taken up in chapter 10. Chapter 10 is entitled The Laws of Diminishing Marginal Product and Diminishing Marginal Utility. Let me now read to you some highlights from that chapter. A production function is a relationship between inputs and outputs. It illustrates how many workers and machines it might take to produce, for example, one car, two cars, etc. And you will see in chapter 10 a table showing how typically adding an additional worker adds output. As you can see from the table in chapter 10, total production rises with additional workers. The rise in production is not proportionate, though. The first few workers contribute more per worker than the last few. But the drop in additional production after a certain number of workers, in this example, the third worker, is known as the law of diminishing marginal product. There are different types of input that affect output. Fixed inputs are resources which the firm keeps constant in the short run. Variable inputs may increase or decrease as production increases or decreases. And it goes on to say, examples of resources that are typically fixed in the short run are land, heavy machinery, and buildings. Resources that are usually variable in the short run are energy, labor, raw materials, and supplies. The short run is a time period in which a business has at least one fixed input, for example, a building. The long run is a time period in which the firm has the flexibility to change all inputs. So the law of diminishing marginal product relates not only to workers, but also to other inputs. The law states that when a firm uses a variable input, such as labor, the productivity of workers who are hired at a later stage is less than the additional productivity of workers who were hired first. And you notice here, it gives even, you know, why is that the case? Why do we find in our observation of different firms that this law of diminishing marginal product is the case? Well, the reason it is often the case is that, you know, when you add a certain number of workers after already you have almost a factory full of workers, each additional worker you have, as it says, is almost stumbling over the next, and really unhelpful, or at least less helpful, to the overall output than an earlier additional worker. So there is this this law that can be observed that as one adds more inputs, one does not increase outputs as much as when one added inputs at an earlier level. Now, quite analogous to the law of diminishing marginal product is the law of diminishing marginal utility. To understand this law of economic behavior, it is first necessary to understand what is meant by marginal utility. Marginal utility is the additional satisfaction one gets from consuming one more item of a good or service. It can be observed by induction that for most things, humans tend to get less additional satisfaction the more of them they have. Someone with no shoes very much appreciates getting a pair of shoes. Someone is happy to receive a second pair, though perhaps not quite as appreciative as with the first pair. And so on, the satisfaction diminishes as the pairs of shoes accumulate. This is typical of consumption of most material things. The more you have of something, the less additional each additional unit is worth to you. And this is called the law of diminishing marginal utility. Proverbs 25:16 actually points out the law of diminishing marginal utility using the example of honey. It reads, "Hast thou found honey? Eat so much as is sufficient for thee, lest thou be filled therewith and vomit it." This phenomena of the law of diminishing marginal utility explains why if you are shopping in a supermarket, you only buy a limited quantity of goods. While the law of diminishing marginal utility is true of material things, Scripture evinces that it is not true of spiritual things. The more we know God, the more we want to know and enjoy Him yet more. So we find that based upon our experience, in an observation of economic conditions, these laws of diminishing marginal product and the law of diminishing marginal utility are the case. Now, I had pointed out at the end of this chapter 10 that there is a distinct difference between material and spiritual things when it comes to human satisfaction. And that is a theme that is focused upon in chapter 11, which is entitled The Temporality of Material Riches. Just some highlights from that chapter. It says, "Wealth is not static, nor is poverty. Over and again in history, we see that those nations which were once wealthy are later in history brought low. What's more, individuals and families as well experience the rise and fall in wealth. The industrialist Andrew Carnegie rose from rags to riches, yet there are many cases of children that have squandered the wealth inherited from their parents. The temporality of riches and its moral lesson is captured in these words of Jesus Christ in his Sermon on the Mount. Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." So, again, the temporality of material riches is a lesson are a law that can be observed in the economics of societies as well as in the economics of firms and even individuals. So chapters 10, 11, and 12 are what we have covered in this class. And this now concludes the lecture for class number 5. The assignments for chapters 10 and 11 are due by the class number 7. Those who want to do the extra credit work should do the work described in Exhibit 4 for these chapters 10 and 11. We shall need to cover more material related to chapter 12, however, in our next two classes.